Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Ken McKean. Welcome you to Nature's Talk Show, and tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. I'm joined with Ken Borman, and we both want to welcome you to... Please go to www.naturestalkshow.com here and join in our live chat room, because Ken will be in there to field questions and comments and stuff. So without further ado, hello, Ken. How's it going?
I'm very well tonight. Thank you, Ken. I hope you are, too.
Yeah. Once again, we're enjoying here in the desert southwest some beautiful weather, and we're going to be getting out into the field here real soon, Ken.
Sounds promising.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'm hoping to get out into the field here and do some research before our next show, because you and I are going to talk about the Abbo Formation here in central New Mexico. But tonight, we've got a really cool show. You know, Ken, when I think of an iconic creature that you see in cartoons and in movies and stuff that really represents, you know, something from the prehistoric past, and that's the flying pterosaur Pteranodon. How about you?
Yeah, they have featured quite predominantly in movies, I guess.
Yeah, movies and cartoons and comic
books. To portray, even if sometimes they don't get it 100% right, but they get them pretty close, don't they?
Well, they finally got the modern ones really looking good. You know, it's kind of funny. One of our movies that you and I like to talk about a little bit and everything, because we see some of the little issues it has, and of course it's the third one that has Pteranodon as kind of a villain, and you see the Pteranodon, the pterosaur, you know, he's big enough to carry the kid around, you know, and he's dragging the kid off and everything, and I think it's kind of funny when you look throughout the dinosaur movies and cartoons. They always picture a giant pterosaur like Pteranodon as being because Pteranodon got big. You know, it was a large animal actually for a flying animal.
Yeah, it was a lot bigger than any of the birds that are around today, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was actually surprised when I was a kid to read about, you know, how big it was, and they said, you know, its wingspan's estimated like 24 feet. I think there's been a couple of specimens. I think one of the biggest specimens had a wingspan of 7.25 meters. And, of course, that's just a few inches away from 24 feet. But the average specimen, I guess, or some of the largest that they get, is the Pteranodon longiceps, which gets about... 6.25 meters in wingspan, which is just over 20 feet.
Wow, that's a substantial beast.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny when you think about it, you know, that. But this animal's all wing. That's one of the fascinating things about it. You know, wing, and had a large head. And the body was probably less than, three-quarters of a meter in long, or maybe at best three-quarters of a meter long, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because the biggest pterosaur that I know of, well, that ever was Quetzalcoatlus. Is that related to Pterodon closely or distantly, or what's the story on that one, Ken?
Well, I believe that's fairly closely. I think it belonged to the Asdarchid pterosaurs, which were similar to the pterosaurs that the Pteranodon is from, the Pteranodontidae.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I don't think Quetzalcoatlus has. I think it belongs to a group that doesn't have the crest. Pteranodon seems to belong to the crested pterosaurs, and there were a number of them. But let's go back to and talk a little bit about Pteranodon's famous movies and stuff. Now, when I was a kid, I think one of my I remember a movie that my friend and I went and seen, and I think we all probably went and see it for the same reason back then. I think I was like 14, and It was a crazy dinosaur movie. It had the title of 1 million years BC, and the star I remember from it was Raquel Welch.
Yeah, she rocked that fur bikini, didn't she?
Oh, my gosh. I remember sitting in the front row, me and my buddies, you know, we're sitting there going, oh, yeah, this is okay. We can, you know, so I watched them save Raquel. Yeah, that was pretty funny. But I believe it had Pteranodon in it that was trying to attack her at one point, you know, being its meaty thing, you know. And, of course, it's kind of funny when you watch Pteranodon in these movies like in Jurassic Park and stuff. And because pterosaur appeared to be a fish eater. So fish eaters usually don't go out of the way to attack something, a big hunk of meat that could beat the crap out of them.
No, there is that.
Yeah, you know, so.
Of course, I suppose I wouldn't be averse to picking up some extra protein along the way if something was small enough, would they?
Oh, I bet you there was many a little young dinosaur or something that was along the western interior seaway, you know, coming down to the sea or something, scavenging, and next thing you know, in swoops in one of these big old pterosaurs and plucks him off the beach, you know. Because Pteranodon was actually one of the most common pterosaur fossils found in the western seaway. But it's interesting to note when I was checking out, you know, the areas and where it's found, it appears to have been along the western coastline of Appalachia.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because here in New Mexico, you know, about half the state was covered by the seaway. And although we find rare pterosaur fossils, I believe the one specimen that we do know from here, I think it was an Osdactid pterosaur. As Darkid pterosaur, and I believe its genus name is Navajodactylus.
Wow, that really puts it into a position, doesn't it?
Yeah, because it was found on the Cretaceous Badlands up on the Navajo country in northwestern New Mexico. So,
right.
Anyway, that was one movie I remember Pteranodon. And now the earliest movie I think I can recall seeing a pterosaur, I think Pteranodon, and I was wanting to look it up, and I apologize to our listeners out there because I didn't do this, but I was wanting to go look up the King Kong movie and make sure that was Pteranodon in it. I think you see King Kong killing.
Yeah, there was certainly a flying reptile in that, wasn't there?
Yeah. And so I remember seeing it in that. Now, this is kind of funny. I remember, and I barely remember the movie because it was so god-awful. But I believe there's a movie out there called Pteranodon or Pterosaur. And
really?
Yeah, and it's like a grade B minus movie. And it featured pterosaurs attacking people.
So that'll be like a stop-go action movie.
Well, kind of like CGI. It wasn't all that old.
All right. It was CGI.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It, like I said, one of those late night sci-fi channels that you see on satellite TV or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching
mm-hmm.
some of these movies, and another one they had on was Mosquito, and about these giant mosquitoes, you know.
Right.
But
yeah.
These pterosaurs were attacking people and ripping them apart. Now, this is another interesting thing about Pteranodon and its relatives. By the Cretaceous period, pterosaurs had lost their teeth.
Right.
Yeah.
So they couldn't rip much apart with their teeth at all.
At all.
Maybe with their claws, I guess.
Well, even those weren't really all that big and powerful, you know.
No.
Yeah, most of the time the claws were built into the leading edge of the wing.
I'm trying to save these movies here. I can't save them, can I?
You'll have to try to find the one about the pterosaurs, you know.
Yeah, I'll go for a look. Try and find it.
Yeah, sci-fi movie.
Of course, another movie that they were in, too, was Jurassic Park.
Yes.
I can't remember if it was three or four. I can't remember. But in one of the original series of Jurassic Park, they were trying to get through an aviary of pteranodons.
Yeah. Yeah, that
was... Well, pterosaurs anyway. I don't know if
that
it was
pteranodon, one, yeah.
But it was some... Yeah, it was some sort of pterosaur. And, of course, in the remake that just came out recently, they figure fairly prominently in that, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you'll have to go and see that if you can, Ken. It's, I can recommend it. It's a good action movie.
Cool, good deal. Well, because one of the things I like doing is adding these movies to my collection, and here in a few days we'll be going out on a movie search, so I'll definitely keep that one in mind. Got to watch it anyway. It's dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but they've kind of done their homework a little bit better this time.
Oh,
it's
there
still
you go.
Not perfect, but it's better.
Yeah. You know, another movie I remember watching is made back in the 60s, I believe, and I think the original came out way back in the 30s or something. But that was based on a book by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle called The Lost World. Do you remember seeing that movie?
I love that book. I read that first when I was about 8, and I was going to one of the tepuis in South America to find those damn dinosaurs.
You know, it's funny, that book, I got to admit, inspired me when I was a kid, too. You know, we used to play a dinosaur adventure when we were young. We were pretending like the alleyway in the back of the house was a big prehistoric river, you know, with paleonicid fishes and coelacanths in it and stuff. And this is back when I was like in fifth grade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we used to do these adventures. It was a lot of fun, you know, pretending. I read the book.
To answer your question, I have seen that movie. I didn't see it when it came out. I specifically went and purchased it from Amazon within the last 2 years anyway, and it's a great comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really interesting, too, because we see what the dinosaur logic was back then, too, you know, how Hollywood...
Yeah.
You know, in the 60s and stuff, viewed these animals and stuff, because it's a lot different than what we see them now. I mean, you watch the modern pterosaurs and stuff, you know, or like we see in Jurassic Park, you know, they've brought the dinosaurs up into the realm of the birds, you know, where they're fast-moving and smart. And so it's interesting to watch the evolution of the movies and stuff. You know, now another interesting thing, too, I remember as a kid seeing Pteranodon in, and this was a comic book. I know I mentioned this occasionally because it was one of my favorite comics as a kid, and that was a story about these two Indians that got lost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Andar and Turok. And the comic book was called Turok, Son of Stone. And I remember one of my favorite issues had a cut on the cover of Pteranodon. And I think that was fared into the story in the comic, you know. But, yeah, I remember, you know, being impressed by that, too. I liked Turok, Son of Stone, when I was a kid. I used to read all of them.
Yeah, that was a great comic. I read them. I collected them for a while, but then I lost them. They're somewhere in Australia, my Turok collection.
Yeah.
I don't know who ended up with them. I hope they enjoyed them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty cool stuff. That's it. Now, another place that you see Pteranodon popping up in all the time, too, are the comics. BC. you know, I think Pteranodon, you know, figured well in that one. How about the Flintstones?
Yes, there is... one hanging around in the opening credits of the Flintstones, isn't there? I think from memory.
Well, one thing I find fascinating is how in the Flintstones they used pterosaurs that look like Pteranodon for airplanes.
Yeah.
I think that's what that one museum in Kentucky was based upon an episode of the Flintstones or something.
Very probably.
Wishful thinking, huh? What else have we seen these crazy creatures in, you know? I know something else that Trinodon has popped up into, and it's years ago built a model. And I think Monogram Models was the company at the time. A bunch of years ago, and I remember taking this model Trinodon, and I painted it colors similar to an albatross when I did. Yeah, because when I studied the different birds, one of the things that you and I talk about a lot on the show here is convergent evolution.
Right.
And, and when we're looking at the seabirds, you know, most of the time we see a bird with, you know, that's grayish and whitish. So I give the pterosaur with a grayish upper area, upper wing surface, I guess, and upper body, and did the underparts whitish, kind of like a modern albatross. And
it was pretty good.
It was a lot of fun building it. You know, I had a great time. I wish I could find more prehistoric animal models out there. I'd like to get back into them. The kid in me still loves building a good model. Excuse me. Got a frog in my throat here again. Now, fossils of these animals have been found in the Niobrara Chalk. And for our listeners, Ken and I... we talked about the Inland Sea a few episodes ago, so you can go back and check that out. But for the most part, Dimetrodon is only found in a short period of the Western Inland Sea of just a few million years.
Pteranodon.
Or Pteranodon, what did I say?
Dimetrodon.
Dimetrodon. No, I'm thinking Dimetrodon. It's sorry, but I'm glad you picked that out. It's like
you're thinking about going back in the field, aren't you?
Oh, I am, because I'm seriously going for that to bag that big one that I found last year. You know, I'm going out to find more of those specimens because they're down there. They're there. I knew it. I found one. Excuse me, but at any rate. For the most part, there appears to have been two species, and it seems that these species evolved from one into the other. I think the lineage was around 4 million years or so. So we're talking, you know, just enough time, you know, for a couple species to evolve. So Trinodon, although it's impressive how many there were, you know, it's kind of interesting how short-lived the overall lifespan of the genus was. This is a short-range genus.
Yeah, actually, I was surprised when I did my research for tonight's show. This is one of the animals that Marsh named.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been around for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's what I found interesting, too, you know. And once again... this animal helped fuel the Marsh Cope wars, too, you know. but, yeah, Charles, excuse me. but Marsh described the specimen first, I think, from wing bones.
Yeah, and of course, Pteranodon. Means winged and toothless.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the name of it, you know, winged and toothless.
Yeah.
And because that's, you know, because Trinodon. Now, it's interesting, when these pterosaurs were first discovered, Marsh, when he first found the pterosaur, he picked up a tooth from one of the fishes that live in the Inland Sea, and he thought the tooth went along with the skull. And as more and more specimens were discovered, it's found out that these pterosaurs had actually evolved a toothless beak. And unlike the birds, which have a horny beak, these guys here appear to have kept the jaw bones as their main way of catching something. You know, they didn't have a horny beak over their jaws as much.
So it was more like a skin covering?
I guess like a gum, that? I guess.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, you know. Now, one of the things that impressed me, besides the size of this when I was a kid, and I loved the crest on this particular animal.
Yeah, it was different, wasn't it? It was that kind of back sweep, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I thought it made it look really graceful, you know. And, once again, when start looking at the early paleontologists when they're finding these strange animals, you know, and they're starting to put features, you know, it's name these features. What were they for, you know? We see like in Stegosaurus, you know, the bony plates were thought to have been for heat regulation. Dimetrodon, the sail, was thought to be for heat regulation. Some of the other sailed pelicosaurs. And we see these exaggerated growths. And one of the things that we've talked about on this show here is how we believe, or especially I believe, that an exaggerated structure is usually for sexual selection. You know, females are looking for the most robust male because it's a jungle out there.
Yeah.
When it comes, it's a jungle. You know, you'll get yourself eaten out there in the world. So these animals, you know, they pick for the more robust, strongest. And when the sails start developing in Pteranodon, you know, we're seeing that some Pteranodon males, because we do see sexual dimorphism in Pteranodon. There are differences in males and females. So when we look at these, dimorphisms here, you know, we see that some of the males had big exaggerated sails. And that, I believe, was, you know, showing a dominant male. You know, these mm-hmm. things. And I bet the sails were pretty colorful, too.
I would think so, too. They were a good bit bigger than the females, weren't they? Overall,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, actually, when you look at Pteranodon longiceps, the females appeared to be around 12 feet or so in a wingspan, and the males were almost 6 feet wider. That's not, you know... what are we talking about? 3 meters as opposed to 4 meters, 4.5 meters.
Yeah, that's quite a difference.
Mhm. So they had the larger wingspan, but the females had differences in their pelvic regions that seemed to allow for eggs. So they most likely these were egg layers. Now, an interesting thing about pterosaurs that you and I discovered when we had a show on pterosaurs was that the young hatch out almost ready to fly on pterosaurs.
Right.
They call them flaplings. That's kind of fascinating about these animals. So when we look at the fossils of Pteranodon, basically what we see is they grow bigger. You know, that's when we start seeing the crest grow, et cetera, you know, and they just basically just turned into bigger individuals from what they hatched out.
And, of course, we must remind all our listeners, too, that they're not actually dinosaurs, are they?
No, they're not. They are in the archosaur lineage because they share skull features and a few other features with archosaurs. I think their ankles still retain the archosaur matchup. We do know that they are derived from those. And they started out back in the Triassic period as the terrestrial quadrupedal reptiles, probably ended up taking to the trees, becoming arboreal. And we see today different animals that have taken up an arboreal lineage, and although they haven't taken on true flight, like the birds and bats, we do see things like... be flying lemurs, flying squirrels, flying frogs, flying snakes, gliding lizards.
Lizards, yep. There's quite a few, isn't there?
There are. I believe there's a gliding marsupial, isn't there?
Let me think. Oh, yeah, of course. The little sugar glider.
Sugar gliders, yeah. See, so we've got all these groups here that are coming up with this convergent evolution on jumping from tree to tree by forming gliding, you know. So it's not, to me, too surprising that back in the Triassic, you know, a group of animals, you know, found a, once again, a complete ecosystem that's unexploited. Because the only thing that was flying up until the advent of the pterosaurs appeared to be in just insects.
Wow. So, first off, I guess it would be a great avenue to escape predation, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. We see when we watch some of the modern animals, you know, they'll use that technique to jump from, you know, to another tree or something like that, and they're able to get away from small felines or something like that that's after them and different things, you know. So definitely that's one way. Also, of course, as I mentioned, you know, the ability to exploit a food source that hasn't been exploited very much.
Mm-hmm.
And once these animals started developing the ability for free flight, you know, kind of funny, Ken, but the saying the sky is the limit, was culminated in animals like Quetzalcoatlus and Pteranodon.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, if they hadn't have died out when they did, perhaps the birds wouldn't be as they are today, but it is a shame that they did become extinct when they did, isn't it?
I think so. I like the pterosaurs. I like the shape. I like, you know, just they're just a very fascinating animal to me, you know. And I do. I wish we could see them. It's the best we got today is convergence on some of the birds.
Mm-hmm. But nothing is as big and majestic.
Oh, what's that?
But nothing is big and majestic anymore.
No. And I think there's a reason for that, too, Ken. I think it has to deal with the wing.
How so, Ken? Can you explain that one to me?
Okay. Well, one of the things I've done since I was young, too, is I've always studied aerodynamics. I guess you could call me the infernal science geek, you know, because I studied all this stuff. I mean, when it comes to science, listeners out there, yes, I studied it all. I love science because it all works together. And the aerodynamics on a supersonic jet fighter, because I got to admit, I love the sound of a full rumbling afterburner, you know. But when you look at wing, there's things called wing loading, aspect ratio, and different things that go into making a wing a wing. Wing-a-whack. But when we look at, the different wings, you want to, for a high maneuvering we say either airplane or a bird even, because this works on birds. We're seeing, interestingly, automobiles are forcing an evolutionary change in some of the bird species here in North America, and it's causing sparrows to actually develop shorter wingspans. Okay?
What's that for, Ken?
Maneuverability.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the shorter your wingspan is to its width ratio, the faster you can roll, the faster you can turn. So these little birds are developing the ability to dodge cars by being able to outmaneuver getting smacked into. It's taken out, basically cars have taken out the slow birds, you know, and the faster birds are the ones that are passing their genes on. So we're seeing this little, you know, evolutionary change caused by a modern, you know, environment. Now, that's for fast-turning birds. And we also notice that when you see these sparrows, do they glide very much? You know, they're really beating their wings a lot. You probably noticed that, haven't you?
Yeah,
they
did flap a lot.
Yeah. Now, what we want is for a bird that's going to glide a lot, like an albatross, because an albatross is a modern analog to pteranodon. So we look at that, and we have what's called a high aspect ratio wing. And what that means is its length to its width at its base is a lot longer, so much percentage greater. So you have a long, narrow wing. And these long, narrow wings are great for picking up air currents and maneuvering a bird on slight air currents that occur and things, because we see albatrosses able to glide in what seems almost, you know, no air currents. So you got this you get this high lift wing that also has another interesting feature over what I consider the bird wing, and that's it's a living wing. What we mean by that is this whole wing structure on the pterosaur was muscles and tendons, and the muscles and tendons could be bent and curved by you know, thought control with these animals, and they could actually probably had greater aerodynamic control, you know, of their flight, you know, their wings than a bird does, because a bird has these hard feathers. There's one length, you know, you got your flight feathers, then you got your secondaries that cover the forward edges of the wings, you know, to give it an aerodynamic flow. Now, one of the interesting things, too, is that when you look at a bird wing, you will see the classic aerodynamic shape in that wing. Have you ever done that, looked at a bird wing and checked out the airfoil shape?
Yeah, I did that often. I keep small parrots, and I've got to clip their wings every now and again. So I'm very familiar with the shape of a bird wing, actually.
It's pretty cool, isn't it? I mean, you said that you see it kind of, curved in a little bit underneath. You got the curve over the top, so it allows the air to flow faster, which causes the pressure differentiation on the surface of the wing. And these pterosaurs were probably able to curve their wing more to cause them to bend, able to make the wings higher, lower lift. They probably had beautiful control out to the wingtips, even, because, you know, the living wing. So I think that was probably the main structure that allowed pterosaurs to get up to the almost 40-foot wingspan of a Quetzalcoatlus and still fly.
Mm-hmm. So basically, the shorter the wing, the faster you have to beat it. Would that be correct?
Yeah, you got to keep your speed. A real good example of that would be, what's a real good example of a wing with a, I guess you can say a glider. A glider has a high aspect ratio, long and narrow, you know. But
right. You
don't want to do high-speed maneuvers in a glider. Now, you take an F-104 Starfighter. Are you familiar with that airplane?
I think so.
Yeah, a little. It used to come as a supersonic jet fighter out of the 60s. Real short, stubby wings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it had a roll rate that was phenomenal. How fast it could roll in a wing round, you know. And that was because of the wings, you know, shallow wing surface. But you can't do that with the big long wing of a glider. They don't maneuver very good at all. But they'll carry you a long ways. You can get a long distance out of these wings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we see, the difference between a sparrow and an albatross. Because these smaller birds have to really use their wings. Like a hummingbird. Hummingbird's a good example of a bird that doesn't have a gliding wing at all. It's all for generating lift.
Right.
Yeah. And a hummingbird does, rarely have I seen a hummingbird pause its wings in flight. Usually they, keep them going all the time till they set down, land, you know. So there's another example of a small wing, you know, that, it does phenomenal things for the bird. These birds are able to do jetpack stuff, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what they can do compared to an albatross, you know. But an albatross can't do hummingbird maneuvers, but it can glide across an ocean. And hummingbirds have to fly all the way across.
Right.
You know, so
that would be using all that energy to flap their wings, whereas the gliding one is just not exerting any energy, basically. Just picking the air currents, isn't it?
Yeah. And It appears that is what these big pterosaurs were doing out over the Western Seaway, including Pteranodon and Quetzalcoatlus. They were gliding on the things. Now, there's some other interesting things, too, about Pteranodon I found fascinating, how it was could have possibly been a diving type of pterosaur. Right? Actually, how you see some of the seabirds today where they'll dive, you know, from an altitude and hit the water, you know, like I think gannets, is that one of them? I think it's a good diving bird.
I was just thinking that, actually, as we were talking on wingspan and everything, they would be able to dive at a phenomenal speed, wouldn't they? Because
yeah.
of the way they were built.
I bet. And, you know, but it appears, though, that they could actually... by studying the floor body structure of a pterosaur and comparing or Pteranodon, comparing it to the modern diving birds, it's as beefy as the modern diving birds are. So it's thought that Pteranodon actually was a diving pterosaur. You know, it dived down on these fish. You know, the Western Interior Seaway was full of fish. And
right.
It probably dived down, you know, and grabbed a big old fish and, you know, back up and out, you know. They say, even if it floated and was reaching for fish, because of the length of its beak and its neck and stuff, it still had a heck of a reach, you know, where it could, you know, wait for fish to come and snag them.
Wow. Do you think, something that big could take off from the water?
I bet it could. And,
that'd be interesting.
Yeah, you know, now I wonder, now one of the things that modern birds have that do live in the, around seaways is they have oil glands that
mm-hmm.
They use, and when you see birds preening, that's what they're spreading this oil around, and to make them waterproof. And I wonder if pterosaurs, now pterosaurs appeared to have a type similar to fur. It was a coating, you know, I don't think it was quite hair. I don't think it had the same structure as hair, but they had a coating of fine fibers that appeared to, you know, like a fine hair, and they probably had this all over the body. And I wonder if they would have had to preen to, you know, to make it waterproof or not.
Again, that'd be interesting to find out. I guess it'll be much like a quill, maybe.
Hmm.
Little short quills, maybe.
Yeah, well, they're real fine. So, but yeah, it another invention that nature took care of on causing putting a coating on an animal to help insulate it, and I believe it probably aided in the flight because it's kind of interesting how air works. You know, sometimes when you have a wing structure and you want to cause vortices and stuff like that. Sometimes on airplanes, we put little vanes and stuff, but sometimes animals can use their birds can use their feathers by twisting them and stuff, you know, to cause these little intricacies in the wing. So,
yeah, that's what the raptors do, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can see them actually, they got the muscles to twist their feathers, flight feathers, and adjust them a little bit, and that gives them quite a bit. Now, this is interesting, too, because the small hawks that we see, especially like here in New Mexico, we have a lot of the little falcons and peregrines and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And another one we have is, I think they're called little red-tailed, or not red-tailed hawks, little sparrow hawks. And these birds can, you ought to watch them after when they're chasing a sparrow. You got this sparrow he's moving into a tight area, you know, as fast as he can go. And right on his, just inches behind him will be this hawk, you know, maneuvering every bit as, you know, just following his prey. Especially
mm-hmm.
it's really fascinating to watch him shooting through tree limbs and branches and stuff, you know, as this little bird's trying to get away. And a lot of times, then, we watch these hawks succeed in catching their prey. It's amazing.
I've seen the sharp-shinned hawks up here do that.
Yeah.
Chasing other little birds, and invariably they catch them. even through the forest, as you say, with all the trees that the little birds can dart around, the sharp shins seem to be able to maneuver very well, and they invariably catch them.
Yeah.
So I guess the pteranodon maybe had the same capability.
I would say it did not. I say it probably was a slow glider, you know, probably not having a very fast top speed at all.
Because of the size of the wing.
The size, yeah.
Yeah.
I bet it could have been a heck of a glider, though. You know, Ken, probably being along the beach, you know, looking out over the Western Seaway there, you know, and seeing because it appeared to be there was, you know, numbers of these. It would have probably been amazing, you know, seeing schools of 20-foot, or flocks of 20-foot pterosaurs, you know, feeding just offshore.
Yeah, it would have been a sight.
Yeah, amazing time. And, well, sadly, even though we have this particular part of the Inland Sea preserved here in New Mexico, we cannot find this particular pterosaur here. During the Coniacian, yeah, and the companion stages. We have a lot of companion dinosaurs and stuff here, and I think the companion age might have been when that one Navajo Dactylus pterosaur was found.
Have any of the paleontologists back at the museum hypothesized on why you don't find them in New Mexico, Ken, at all?
No, I've not heard anybody really mention much about these here. It doesn't seem to be much of a study. When I did talk to Dr. Spencer Lucas, the head curator of the museum here in New Mexico, he said pterosaurs are so rare here in the States, you know, that chances of finding them is really tough. And nobody, because they're so scarce, nobody really goes out of the way to try to find them. Now, I'm wondering then, with that point of view, has nobody just not took the time and went out and started looking at these particular this particular age of the Manco shell and stuff here in New Mexico? And there's probably just a good chance that what somebody needs to do, myself maybe, is go out and start walking these deposits where they're exposed and see if I can't come across some pteranodon bones. And that'd be the interesting, because that'd be the first person to discover pteranodon here in New Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah, because
so you can do is study your maps and work out where they're likely to be then.
Yeah, yeah. And there's some nice exposures of this particular age. And but yeah, it appears like Kansas, Wyoming, and South Dakota, those are states that border the eastern side of the Seaway.
Mm-hmm.
And also you can find these up in Manitoba, Canada, I believe.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And Manitoba is about two countries over. What do you call them, states up there?
Provinces? Provinces, yeah.
Provinces, okay.
Manitoba, that's one province over.
Oh, really?
Ontario is a huge province there.
Yeah. So looking up here, checking out a map with it, shows it on this part, once again, on the eastern part. So it appears that pteranodon, unless one of us gets lucky out here on the western side, appears, like I said, to have been there on the eastern side of the Western Interior Seaway.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, isn't it?
It's very interesting. So I know I might have to take and make a couple trips up to it's actually somewhere where this age rock is exposed here in New Mexico, the Seaway. It's not that far away. It can be done in a couple-hour drive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah, you would think that something that could glide like that would certainly be able to glide across the Inland Sea.
It's only when you look at it, I mean, it's at its shortest part appears to be just across, well, from New Mexico to west, the eastern side of Texas, the Panhandle. That's about, I've driven that in like a 6-hour drive.
Well, for
my car.
Something that could glide like this, that's nothing really, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be maybe a 24 or so hour, you know, glide. But maybe they only went out just, 100 or so, maybe a couple hundred miles away from shore. Maybe they did not stray from shore, you know, very far.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they did not, here's the thing, is they did not evolve, you know, before the Seaway came in, their type, you know, so their evolution would have been on the eastern side, they're on Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, within that 2 million years, you know, they probably died out before they had a chance to cross over the Seaway. It probably just didn't happen. Another interesting thing is usually the trade winds and stuff where we're talking about would have probably been blowing from the southwest again and keeping, the pattern of their gliding restricted again once again across the Seaway.
Right.
So that might have been the real reason why we don't see them on this side is because they just hadn't evolved to glide across the Seaway yet.
Mm-hmm. And do we know why they died out, Ken?
I don't think we have a really good idea unless another type of pterosaur overwhelmed their their species, maybe like Quetzalcoatlus, because it came after these guys.
A newer, bigger model kind of thing.
Newer, bigger model, yeah. And as darked pterosaurs, they probably were the reigning pterosaurs, and Pteranodon couldn't compete.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably what happened to them. Now, there's a lot more of our research listeners out there. There's some good books on pterosaurs that they should really go and get. These are amazing animals. They don't have the best fossil record because, like birds, pterosaurs have delicate skeletons. So what we usually see when we're finding these fossils, we're finding wing bones maybe or something like that here. The one pterosaur, Navodactylus, was actually just part of one of the finger bones of its flight finger.
Right, and not having teeth wouldn't help either, would it?
What's that?
And not having teeth, that wouldn't help either.
Well, yeah, I think if part of the skull was found, I think if part of the skull of this was found, it would probably not be called Pteranodon just because of the age difference. It's a lot younger. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is probably, and more than likely, I would say Navodactylus would be the pterosaur that evolved on this side of the interior Seaway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this was its part of the world,
That makes sense.
Yeah, because we had to have our pterosaurs as well. If Pteranodon lived on that side, there had to be pterosaurs that were existing on this side.
That's right.
Yeah, so I'm going to go out and try to find some. matter of fact, we always keep our eye out when we're looking for fossils to find anything new and unusual, but I'd love to find a pterosaur. That's on my bucket list of animals to find.
Well, we're fairly confident that they're out there somewhere. It's just a matter of doing the miles and keeping your eyes open, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'll be picking up some new shoes here soon. Yeah, it's getting about time to retire the one pair, so.
I was just thinking for our listeners to go and have a look at a reconstruction of a Pteranodon. Most museums would have one or some sort of pterosaur anyway in their collection, wouldn't they?
Yeah. New Mexico Museum of Natural History, it's had its different pterosaurs. I think right now we've got some Triassic pterosaurs specimens that are there. But the American Museum of Natural History or the Smithsonian Institute, definitely go check them out for their fossils. The Field Museum of Natural History up in Chicago, I imagine. I'd really want to go back to their Hall of Dinosaurs. It'd be nice to go back and say.
I would have thought that they would have been. But thinking back to when I was there, it was only about 10 years ago, I can't remember seeing a pterosaur there.
Really? I'll be darned.
I mean, I've got no doubt that they've got one, but I just can't remember it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've got a photo of it, which is strange because I tried to take a photo of everything.
Now, they're at, when, let's see, what they have on, no, that wasn't a pterosaur either. That was an Archaeopteryx. They had the real original, one of the original Archaeopteryx at Smithsonian.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, when I was there. Yeah, they had a replica next to it, so you could see what a replica looked like compared to the original fossil.
Wow.
And it was cool seeing an original Archaeopteryx.
That would have been good. That was online from Germany or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely was. And neat little neat animal. One of these days we'll have to profile Archaeopteryx on the show.
Different beastie entirely, isn't it?
Oh, we'll be going back to the theropods.
Yeah.
Yeah, back a true dinosaur. Because they were the third animal, or the second animal, well, third, I guess, because you got the insects, pterosaurs, then the birds, and then the last group of animals to discover flight was the mammals, the bats. But at any rate, for anybody that wants to go collect these fossils, I would recommend going to some of the Cretaceous deposits in Kansas. Some of the outcrops there, up through Wyoming and South Dakota, you can find pterosaurs there. So, but yeah, go check them out and see what you can find because pterosaurs are rare. They're a lot of fun to collect. Now, one thing to remember is collecting vertebrate fossils in most states is illegal. On state or federal lands, if you collect on private property, please be sure you get permission from the landowners because the landowners are the original owners of these fossils. And I actually have a real good rapport with ranchers and stuff, and I've been able to collect on many, many private properties out here collecting my Permian vertebrate fossils. So that's been a wonderful thing. Always say please and thank you to these people. They appreciate that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Respect their gates. Always respect a gate. Never mess with their livestock, either. They don't appreciate that. Of course, some of these people out here, some of the ranchers that we go on, the ranch land, one guy breeds rodeo bulls, Ken, and I've been within 20, 30 feet of one of his rodeo bulls out in the field once.
Oh, you don't want to do that too much, Ken.
Oh, I was taking some pictures. We were collecting in the Abbo Pass down the Abbo Formation, and I was taking some pictures of some lichens on the rocks. And
mm-hmm.
I happened to look over, and about 25, 30 feet away was this great big old monster of a bull chewing away on some grass. And the way the wind was blowing, it was blowing with us, you know.
Wow.
And he couldn't see or smell me, and I seen him though, and I think I had my dog with me too. It's like but we gently, carefully blended back into the junipers.
Mm-hmm.
And quietly as I could, me and my dog, we put some distance between us. But one of the things that we have to be careful with when we're out in the field is things like bulls. We come across them. You know, so more scary than a rattlesnake.
Yeah, oh yeah. They can do a lot more damage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, but anyway, finding these things like that, are, you know, Ken, it's a lot of fun. I got to admit, it's nothing like working around and picking up something, and especially if you know what you're finding. That's a whole lot of fun there.
Right. And of course, all the pterosaurs were extinct by the time of the KT.
Yeah, they were dying out. It's funny because there were some major climate changes going on at the end of the Cretaceous period, appears. We lost a major bunch of life, and it appears there might have been a couple 1-2 punch on Earth that led to the main extinction. A meteor strike or asteroid strike, along with some major volcanic activity, that would have. It appears that both of these incidents by themselves weren't quite enough to cause the major extinction, but you put the two of them together and life took a major blow.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah,
can
I just run something by you? I saw something the other day.
Please.
They hypothesized that, you know, the Siberian traps. How they were set off. They hypothesized that something like an asteroid impact on the other side of the world set that off. What do you think about that?
It's funny. I've thought about that in the past, too. Because if a big enough thing hit the Earth, would it? How much crustal damage could it cause? And I've read about that too, and I think there's a possibility that something like that could have happened. That these were volcanics were set off by a major impact that caused the crust. Because when you got these shock waves going out, and a good example of that, Ken, I think, is if we look at the planet Mercury. Mm-hmm. And the planet Mercury appears to have been hit with something so hard that it actually caused it to have at the opposite side of the planet project, where showed where it got smacked.
Right.
The pressure waves came together. And for a long time, mm-hmm. they had trouble explaining this particular formation. Now they believe that's what that is. So it possibly could have happened. Now, another interesting thing, too, you're familiar with the Tunguska event,
yep.
right, in 1908?
Yep.
Well, one of the papers that I read recently that was published in one of the news bulletins by the Museum of Natural History suggested that back during the Permian-Triassic end crisis, that an impact over Tunguska back then caused the volcanics and the mass extinction here on Earth. And so there's evidence that there might have actually been an astronomical event back then.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, so, there's a good possibility, I would say, that to crack the crust like that, it would have took something, pretty massive, and a hefty asteroid strike would do that.
And then I guess the same with the Deccan traps and all of them.
All of them, yeah. So,
it needed something to be a trigger for all of them to go off, wouldn't they?
And that's, I think, the Deccan Traps. So Deccan Traps was in India. And the ones you're talking about was the Permian Traps, wasn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's where the one I read the paper about is probably done by an asteroid event.
Mm.
So, yeah, good chance of it. So, once again, we're at the top of the hour.
We are.
Dang, Ken, these shows go too fast, man. I tell you what, we get to talking paleontology. You and I just we just roar through these shows. Now, next week, you and I got a fun paleontology show. As for our listeners out there, I am a full researcher for the Museum of Natural History here in New Mexico. Been a research associate now for several years. And I study the Permian period here in central New Mexico, the lower Permian, the Assalian-Sacmarian Age. And we're going to be going back out into the field here real soon because the weather's got nice. There's some interesting animals. And next week we're going to revisit the Assalian-Sacmarian of central New Mexico, the Abbo Formation here that we're studying. And I want to go over the plants and animals that we're finding, some of the animals that we're hoping to find, and what the geology of the area means, what the rocks represent, and what we know about this important valley in between the mountain system and the lower Permian. New Mexico appears to, we find the oldest dimetrodons here in the state, and I believe New Mexico here on the western side of Pangaea might have been the center of evolution for dimetrodon, because the Texas dimetrodons are younger. It's going to be an, I think it'll be an interesting talk. So I have a lot of questions for me, Ken.
I'll see what I can do. I'll wrestle some up.
All right. Now, Ken, we got some exciting announcements about you and Tom and Mary coming up here in just a few weeks.
Yes, yes, it's drawing closer. You can finally get to meet all of meet us, as Ken said, Tom, Mary, and myself. We'll all be at the Northeast Council of Aquarium Societies convention at Rocky Hill, Connecticut, on April the 8th to the 10th. It's going to be a great weekend. If you've got any interest at all in fish, you should come out. There's some great speakers going to be there. Some I know personally. Others I know by reputation. Others are going to be completely new to me. So it should be a very interesting weekend. As I say, come out, talk to us. We're going to be interviewing people for the show. Of course, at a fish convention, there's the speakers and then the all-day auction on the Sunday. So you can pick yourself up some cheap fish, hopefully.
I was a guest speaker there. It'll be 2 years ago, this coming show. And I had a wonderful time there. The people are wonderful. Leslie Dix is a most gracious hostess. I had an awesome time with everybody. Got to hang with my old Killy buddies from that area and stuff. Even went to their Killyfish meeting they held there at the convention. So I got to attend that as well, you know. So I got to hang with my Killyfish and stuff, everything. But it's a wonderful time there, so definitely go. And also, I'm going to be sending artwork with Ken. Ken will be having some artwork that we will be raffling off for the show. So you can help support Nature's Talk Show by winning some of my artwork. Ken and I, and also Ron Bishop, are going to be together at the KOAC show on you guys' long weekend, I believe, Ken, right?
Yeah, in May. It's the weekend
in May, yeah.
Before the American long weekend.
Yeah, so you can come and meet us up there. I'll be doing a talk for the guys in there, Ken Borman and all them, on the evolution of the killifish family. And so it's going to be a very, very interesting talk as I tell you where those fishes come from. And lots of pictures, lots of killifish in it, so it'll be a fun talk. And also, once again, I'll have artwork available for those who want some. And I'm donating some artwork to the KOAC show as well for early entry to the show. Ken will be receiving the paintings I'm donating for those who want to win one. So do enter early for the KOAC show. Also coming up on the American Memorial Day weekend, I will be guest speaker at the American Killifish Fish Association National Convention in Denver, Colorado. That's on Memorial Day weekend. So you can meet me up there and talk with me, talk about art, talk about killifish, or anything else. And see here, that'll be pretty much keeping me busy here coming up, you know, Ken. So,
it's so, a little of that.
Yeah.
There's one other thing we've got to remind people of. Go to our website, naturestalkshow.com. Click on the on-demand episodes. You can, upcoming broadcasts. It takes you to Blog Talk. Sign in there and give us a like. I was just in there tonight. There's 109 people have signed up and liked us. Let's see if we can get it up to 200 in the next month or so. The more people who like us, the better it is.
I'd like to see 1,000 people like us.
It would be great, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, yeah. And also we want you to please ask that you follow us on Twitter and Facebook and iTunes. Leave comments there about the shows and stuff or suggestions. Also, you can leave comments in the chat room about shows. We Ken and I love bringing shows that you want to hear about, you know, about nature and stuff. So we're walking encyclopedias of nature, so you can just almost any nature subject get a hold of us. Sign up, go to our Nature's Talk Show website, of course, and check out and sign up for our newsletter, visit our store. Also, you can go to the PayPal donate button on the site and donate money to help keep the show going, because we are volunteers here. Ken and Mary and Tom and I, we all donate our time to bring you this information. So we hope you do enjoy the shows and that we bring. With that there, Ken, that's all I've got to say, except thank you very much for going back on another prehistoric adventure with me.
Thank you, as always, Ken. It's my pleasure, and I certainly do, and I hope all our listeners learn something with each show.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, with that, thank you, guys. Have a wonderful evening, and join us here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Bye-bye.
Night from me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.